Hi, my name is Harvey Andrews, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
I'm from the sobriety capital of the world. Covina. If you don't think that about your group, get another group. Yeah. But they give me a dollar every time I say that. But I'm glad to be asked. I'm glad to be asked out to talk, and I'm glad to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, really. Wasn't lost too long ago that I thought I had a lot of rights. And when you get so you think you have a lot of rights, you learn to say no. And you learn to say no long enough, you're not around very long. And thank God there's Saviors around for me. But I hate to tell you how long I've been sober. You'll expect me to know something. Yeah. And I know just about as... I know how to stay sober a day at a time. And I've been sober that long, since December the 29th, 1957. And that's without pot, bill or booze of any kind. But you notice that date, December the 29th, nobody in their right mind gets sober in between Christmas and New Year's. You got to be ready. You got to surrender either one. Gee, you can stay out there three more days. You know, we could have a hell of a party. You know? And I turned in my cork and had a lot of opportunities over the years to put myself into a position to want to go out there again, but I haven't taken advantage of any of them, you know, or disadvantage, whatever you want to call it. Because a lot of people have done a lot of homework for me over the years and seen a lot of things, and I be surprised how many people I've buried over the years, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, because they said, but you don't seem to realize my case is different, you know. And we just had one here a few weeks ago with a guy, his case was different. He wound up in a wheelchair with his spinal cord severed, never be able to walk again. And your heart goes right out to these people. If they could, if you only give AA, I suppose, as we used to give it years ago, or else if you could develop some way to put it in liquid form, you could give it to them in an enema about 2 o'clock in the morning. This is the way you do this, kid, you know. But I had a little tough time with this program. You know, I didn't get sober when I first came in my first day, and I didn't walk in and say, gee, isn't it wonderful, I'm going to be sober today. I fought this thing and fought this thing, and up in my mind, not anywhere else. And I got here the first time, they tell me. In February of 1947, but I was 26 years old then, and I had a watch, and I had a job, and I had a car. And in 1947, you didn't have that and come to AA, you know. But of course, in those days, I was built like an Egyptian prince. Now I'm built like a pyramid. You know? You can always tell that when you get to be my age, is when your kids still think that you're an Egyptian prince, and they go out and they buy you tapered shirts for Christmas. And I always tell them, I can't wear it that way. It's this way, it's not that way. I love stories. I don't know about you, but I'm a storyteller. I love to tell stories. I love to tell a story about this kid who wouldn't get up and go to school. Just couldn't get up out of that sack and go to school. And his dad kept saying, please, get out of that bed and go to school. Please get out of that bed and go to school. Kid would grunt and groan. Finally, the old man said to him, look it, give me 2 reasons why you won't get out of that bed and go to school. And the kid says, I don't like them, they don't like me. That's 2 reasons, yeah. And the old man says, I don't go here, kid. You remind me of Pat. He grabbed a hold of the sheet and pulled the sheet off, and he says, you got to remember something. You're 49 years old and you're the principal. You're That sort of reminded me of so many people. I always get a kick of it. I like newcomers. When you see newcomers and spot other newcomers, just like that. They're always looking for that extra thrill or whatever it was. All newcomer always reminds me of a hawk. You know, a hawk is a tremendous hunter. And a hawk has a telescopic eye. I don't know if you know that or not. If you took a hawk apart, his eyeball is about an inch and a half long. They can actually look at something, looking at a fish, you know. They can see it and they can zoom that eye and right on it right away and they start swooping down for it. Reminds me of a newcomer. Swooping down for it. And of course, in water, when they're salmon fishing, they're great fishing. What happens is the water distorts the size, you know, of what they're picking up. The hawk, when he grabs a hold of something, can't let go. Because when it climbs on like this and your talons grab a hold of something like this, if they can't pick it up and carry it away, they can't open up like your hands, like we can, and let it alone, you know. And their claws are just like this. And the prey that they go after most of the time is too big, and the fish actually pulls the hawk down and drowns them. That reminds me of a lot of newcomers coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, chasing a beaver. They run and run and run and run. And they run and run until she finally catches him. And I don't know. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous this last time, and I said I didn't want to be here. I really didn't want to be here. And this guy who took me in my first meeting at Alcoholics Anonymous, he lives down here in San Marcos. I don't know if I pronounced that right or not. But I don't know if he goes to meetings anymore or not. And but I got a kick on when I went up there to turn my cork in that day, and I had it that day one more time, because you know everything was gone in my house. My wife was divorcing me. My three children were gone. The house I lived in didn't have drapes on the walls over the windows. What they had was sheets covering over the windows. You know, there wasn't much furniture inside of that house. It was a drunk's house, is what it was. And half the furniture was sold, and I probably sold most of it. But or hocked it some way. But my dad had told me about a guy who belonged to Alcoholics Anonymous 2 years prior to me getting sober. And he said, "Why don't you go, Harv? Why don't you go one more time? You know, just go." And I couldn't see it that way until after he passed away, and then I went. And I went up to that guy's house to turn myself in. You know how eager we are to get up there and do it. And I went up there and walked right up to his door and went to knock on it and said, "Who needs him? What's he going to tell me? What's he really going to read me out of the book, for God's sakes? Well, tell me about the 12 golden steps of AA, you know?" I went down the street and stood around the street for a while. And I said, "While I'm here, I might as well talk to him." And I walked up again and went to knock on that door and said, "Really? I don't need this crap." And I turned around and I came back. I don't know how many times I walked back and forth up and down that sidewalk till his daughter finally opened the door up before I got there. And she said, "If you want to talk to my father, he's in the backyard. You go around the house, around the fence that way, and you can see him in the backyard." I resented that. You know, she didn't invite me in. She said, "Go on outside." And I was ready, you know, and they turn you away. And the way that house was built, his house was sitting here. There was a wall alongside of this thing right here, and the side wall of the yard going down. And that old fool was sitting in the corner of that wall watching me walk up and down. He wouldn't say, "I'm over here." And I went up. I didn't want anybody in the neighborhood to know why I was there. And so I whispered to him, "Do you belong to AA?" He said, "I've been waiting for you for 2 years, kid, to get in the house, you know." And, or dummy, either one. We're either known as dummy or kid when we're young. But anyway, he took me in the house and sat me down in that. You ever sit in a couch that was built for a newcomer? They wax them before you get there, you know. As soon as you sit in it, you like a wet noodle out on the floor. And he was going to sit there and read to me out of chapter 5 of how it works and explain the book of Alcoholics Anonymous to me, explain the meetings to me. You know, it gets pretty bad when you start to talk right along with him, you know. And I did that, I don't know how many times I fell off that damn couch. I don't know about you, but I was like a wet noodle when I was trying to sober up. He finally got down the floor with me, and he says, "You can't fall off the floor." And I didn't realize that. And we talked and talked and talked, and after a few hours, I finally consented to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. God, I should have begged him to go, you know. What I know today and what I knew shortly after that, I should have begged to go. Please take me, because I need it. There's a potential Al-Anon. I'm just kidding. Another one of those ladies of I won't say it. Our Lady of Perpetual Revenge. But this guy said, "Go on home, Harv, put on a suit, shirt and tie, and take a couple of showers, put on some matching shoes, and I'll take you to a meeting." And I went home to this area where I was living in, and I don't know about you guys, I was married to a woman who had a mouth on her, was that big. It always looked that big when I looked at her. And I said, "Get out my suit, I'm going to AA for you." She says, "You don't own the suit, dummy." And I said, "Well, I went to a couple of funerals, and last year I wore a suit." She says, "That was your brother's? He hasn't talked to you since." And I didn't know that, you know. I was never home, you know. And so they went out and looked for a suit for me to go to AA in. Then my daughters went out and started looking for a suit for me to go to AA in. Then they got the neighbors involved in looking for a suit for me to go to AA. And all the neighbors was out there saying, "You've got to get him something." But I get a kick out of that. If you're new here and you really don't think you're an alcoholic yet, ask your neighbors, you know. You can always tell where an alcoholic lives in your area. The Christmas lights are up in July. Anyway, they found this suit for me to go to AA. And so they brought it in. My father was a big man. It had been too big for my father. Pants get up to here. They put a belt around, folded the pants over, put a double-breasted suit on like this. Folded the sleeves up on the inside, you know. And if I opened the coat up, I looked like a rag picker. I looked like a bag of rags. But I was playing humble. I was like this. And they set me out on the street corner 15 minutes ahead of time so all the neighbors could look at me. "There's Mr. Andrews, he's going to AA." The only tie I owned had a picture of a naked woman painted on it. And they tucked that in. And I went to an AA meeting. They had couches there built for newcomers. There was no springs in them. When you sat down, you were a captive audience. You looked right over your knees, just like this. You had to wait and ask somebody to help you out of your seat. And there was all the newcomers in those days sat in the front row. You didn't get to sit in the back row and, you know, critique the speaker's talk. You had to sit in the front row, and the dollar seats, we used to call them. And I sat up there, and a lady in our area who I got to be well acquainted with, an elderly lady, sat alongside of me and jibed me and connived me about that suit I had on. God, she wanted me to take that coat off. And because there was a puddle underneath me, and it's all mine. And she said, "Take your coat off and be comfortable." I had too much pride. I wouldn't take the pockets had come out of the pants. And they looked funny, you know. I just kept the damn thing together. And this guy who took me to that meeting right after the meeting was over said, "You will now have the most important job you'll ever have in your life. You are now the chief ashtray picker-upper of this group." And I said, "I don't pick up ashtrays." He says, "You do now." And I don't know why I do it. Why do you do this for a sponsor? Why? I don't know why I did the things that he requested me to do something, and I did it not you know, in a hurry, but I did them, what he asked me to do. And I picked up about 3 ashtrays, and some other newcomer had half of my ashtray. And we had a fight over that ashtray. I said, "That's my ashtray." He said, "The hell, it came competitive right off the bat." I thought maybe he was going to count them at the end of the week and see if I got more than one. And I went to a lot of meetings because he said, "I'm not taking any more meetings. This is the only one I'm dating to." And he says, "For a slipper like you," he says, "here's what we would like to have you do." He says, "I'll give you a list of the meetings that you're going to go to. If you have a car, you can drive there, and I'll meet you there. Or if you have money, you can take the bus. If you don't have either, you can walk or run to that meeting, and I'll meet you there." And he did. And he circled 7 meetings for me to go to. I went to a lot of meetings that year. In the first 10 months, I was an Alcoholics Anonymous. I just a crazy person. Really weird. Really weird. I was so full of guilt and self-condemnation. Hell, I just went to meetings to listen to the blood and guts stories that went on. I wasn't interested in what they were reading. I was interested in what they'd completed. All I wanted, what'd they do? Was they in that jail? Was they in this jail? You know, because I did a lot of jail time. And I've been arrested for felonious assault and attempted murder. And I've done a few stints around here. And I've been in hospitals. I've been to psychiatrists. And I wanted the identity. I wanted somebody to identify, you know, with. And the guy I really identified with was Norm Elby. Well, Norm Elby used to say if you couldn't pick it up and carry it away, he'd lay down alongside of it and claim it. I said, "Now there's my kind of a guy." And I was getting a kick out of it. But I was trying to find somebody to identify with, and I found Norm, and I trying to get along in this world and trying to work, and I was unhireable. No one would hire me. And everybody knew me. Who wants to hire a drunk? And I had a hell of a... I had 36 jobs the first year I was sober. You know? You go to fill out your taxes, and you get all these W-2 forms, you know? They bring in, and he says, "God, what do you work every week, you know?" And I had to look around for jobs and do things. One of the jobs I had was cutting grass. The only damn job I could get one time. So I got enough money so I could feed my family if they were still having me, you know. But I had a hell of a time that first year. I didn't do much except go to a lot of meetings. And I say I was around 10 months, and I started to have what I call psychosomatic heart attacks. None of you have ever had any before. If you lay down on your couch when you go home at night, especially if you're new, and you're full of fear, and you feel inadequate and unworthy, and you take your own pulse, and you concentrate hard enough, you can make it skip a beat. And you roll over the couch on the floor and you turn blue. And you just have a free-floating anxiety attack. And that woman I was married to, she'd never call the doctor, she'd call the priest. She was a Catholic. And she'd have the priest come down and give me the last rites. And I said, "Why don't you call a doctor when these things happen?" And she says, "Your insurance is paid." She didn't give a damn what happened. Anyway, I went to some secret meet. I got around this one group, and I wanted to do the steps. I got a book, and I wanted to do the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. My God, it says in here, you know, if you fail to do these, you know, some people think they only lost their egotism and fear. Some people think they've only done this, you know. And then we're back to drinking again. It explains and explains and explains. Chapter 3 is my favorite and my own personal chapter in there. But I went through this thing. I said, "I got to do these steps. I really got to do it." I have a big red book at home, 1939 edition. And I get a kick out. I went to the group and I said, who wrote their inventory in this group? And nobody said anything about writing their inventory. And I got one guy come up and he says, "Do not play over those steps. You're too young. Don't do those until you're sober at least 5 years. Because then you have some semblance of honesty, what you're going to do. Then you see that." So I pulled the group. Nobody was sober over 3. So I said, "Jesus, I went." This guy heard a guy talk one night about him. He said, "Jesus, he talked about the steps. He talked about every darn one of the steps, and I had to go out and hear him again. And I followed him around two or three times, you know, and listened to him. And I said, where did you get all this information? He says, in the book. Yeah, but how do you do these things? He just wants you to come to the meetings that I go to. And he sent me a postcard. There were no step meetings or study group meetings in those days in AA, but they had these two kind of meetings, men and women, you know, speakers and participation, that's all they had. And there was only 127 meetings in the greater Los Angeles area at that time. And there were no study groups in San Diego at that time. The first study group that ever started here started in Chula Vista, because I happened to be there when it was started. You know. But I get a kick. I went to that secret meeting, it's called, and I walked in and they cleared this guy's living room, and all the chairs were out, and everybody was sitting on the floor, and they had their shoes off. And I don't know today why they had their shoes off. But one guy was sitting in the corner, and he had the book up, and he was reading the particular step they were studying that night. And after he got through reading that step, he turned off the light, he lit a candle, and everybody got to talk about what they heard read and how they'd done the step. You know? They didn't talk about who shot John. Yeah, but you don't understand, I haven't got my rent paid. Yeah, no whining. No whining. Shut everything off. We're going to study the step, and that's it. And I got the biggest kick out of that meeting. I liked it. It lasted until 5 o'clock in the morning. And I had to go to work the next day. And I went to work. And I wasn't tired. And because I was getting a lot of knowledge about me and how I can do the things that I'm supposed to do so I won't have to drink again. So I can feel better, you know. Because the only reason I would get drunk again if I got mad at somebody or if my emotions went rampant, you know, or I said, I'll get even with you, SOB, you know, whatever it was. I didn't want to be that way and I wanted to change. And I went to those meetings, and finally, I did all the steps you have to do, because they don't ask you to do anything until you get to the fourth step. The first three, you know, are mostly mental. And then when you get the fourth and fifth and sixth and seventh and eighth and ninth and tenth, then they want you to do something. But what I did was I went back to this group that I belonged to. And I got up there, I was so proud that I had learned, so proud that I knew. I said, I'm going to be of help to mankind, by God. I said, now, you want what I have? He said, no. And they threw me out of the group. And I just had a hell of a time around there until we really started going on those steps, you know. And I remember telling the guy my inventory. And the guy I told my inventory used to live in Chula Vista. And I got the biggest kick out of it, of writing all them dirty, nasty, rotten, filthy things down and telling somebody else and God at the same time all about me. And I told this man things I wouldn't tell 10 different Catholic priests. Really, you know, really deep down stuff. I told, when I used to go to psychiatrists, I wouldn't tell them everything I knew or everything I'd done or everything I thought of, you know. Because they'd look at me funny, I guess. And I just had a hell of a day. Taking work inventories and finding out about why I wasn't working, what I was doing to change my attitude. I had to have an attitude adjustment going most of the time, and AA does that for me. AA does it for me because I seem to seek a higher power when I do the steps. And I'm powerless. I'm really powerless. I don't have any power over anybody whatsoever. I don't even have any power over me half the time. When you get a new manager, it's a lot easier to do. You don't have to rush into things blind, you know, and do the crazy things that I used to do. Anything I say up here is my own opinion, you know that. Because I hate to have somebody say just because he said that it's so, because it's not, you know. I tell you a little bit of my past history. A few minutes. I was born in a beautiful 27-room house. About 30 oak trees in the front yard. A half acre of ground sitting in the middle of town. In my day, when I went to high school, I had a 1929 Model A Sport Roadster painted yellow and black with balloon tires. And had a window seat. And I went to high school in that. And I didn't like, I could have anything I wanted. If I wanted to go sailing, I took a sailboat out. the lake froze over, and if I wanted to go ice boating, I took the ice boat out. If I wanted to go canoeing, I went canoeing. If I went speed boating, I went speed boating. I could do any damn thing I wanted to in that town. That was a beautiful town. Trees overhung the most of the streets. It was all oak streets when I was a kid. You know, and I read in the paper about a guy one day I wanted to be like. His name was Johnny Dillinger. And, God, if I could only be like John. What I wanted really was recognition. I don't give a damn how bad it was. I wanted recognition. I still want it today. You know, when I do something at home for my wife, she doesn't see it in the first 30 seconds when she gets home. I grab her by the arm and lead her over there so she can look at it and she say, "Atta boy." And she passed me on the hip. God, I wanted recognition. I started holding up gas stations and floating crap games and restaurants and markets. And we used to take our stocking cap off and put it over the license plate. You know, so everybody in town knew it was my car. We used that for the getaway car. 55 miles an hour, flat out. You know, anybody could, I could catch it running, I guess. But we was going to do the big caper in that town, and we did it, and we stole this big thing that we wanted to steal, and we put it on the truck, and the guys hit it, and we were going to take it to Wisconsin and sell it, and we were going through a whole bunch of crap there. They didn't want to sell it in town. They took it out and sold it and got arrested. And they got locked up in the county jail, and they called, sent the word out for Harvey. Get Harvey. And Harvey had found at that time a square bottle of Gilby's London Dry Gin in a frosted bottle with a golden red label on it. And he used to drink a lot of that in those days. No vermouth, just gin. And somebody said, "It'd dry you up." I guess it does. But I went up to county jail to see these guys because they wanted to see me. They said, "We want to get out." I said, "How can I help you?" He said, "You can steal a gun and give it to us." And I said, "No way, you know, will I do anything like that." And one of the guys said, "When do you want to get in?" And I said, "Where's the gun?" You know. Fear is a great motivator. Even in AA, it's a great motivator. And what I did was I went out and stole this piece. I can see me doing it yet today. And my sponsor always talks about me. He says, "Harvey's got a story that most people fantasize having, you know, and I lived that damn story." And sometimes I can't believe it was me. That it's been so damn long ago. I said, "I wouldn't have done that. I wouldn't do a thing like that." And yet I did. And I went out and stole this piece. The only way you can get it in the county jail, they didn't strip you in those days, nothing, you know. The sheriff used to come down to my house for dinner, so he knew me, you know. And so I took this piece and I put it in my crotch. But we didn't have breakaway tape in those days. It was this canvas back, thick stuff to use for pleurisy. And I strapped this thing to my leg, you know. And of course, I didn't want to shoot myself, so I put it in wrong. And when I took it out, I talked real high. I've been in one London ever since. But I passed it to the bars and to the guys. And I said, "Don't go today, they'll know it was me." And they didn't go. They went that Saturday. And I thought those two guys were going to get out of the county jail. Everybody get out of the county jail. I took the sheriff with them. And I got out of town. I went back once in 1977. You know? I joined the service at that time. That was in 1938. And they were still taking guys in, and I went in the service, and I got out late in 1945, and I had already had 7 court-martials. And I don't have a battleship discharge. I have a little tiny square piece of paper that says, "For the good of the service." And I was a bosun's mate, and I was a chief bosun's mate, and I was a first-class bosun's mate. Then I was a chief bosun's mate, then I was a first-class bosun's mate. Then I was a second-class bosun's mate. You know? And I went up and down the ladder like a yo-yo. And when I was discharged in New York, and I went through a thing there, I was charged with felony assault and attempted murder. I don't remember that because I was in a blackout, and I wound up in Toombs Prison. And when I got out of that state, and I went to Illinois and became the town drunk. And I married this woman that I was married to for a good many years, a mother of my children. I was married before that to a girl that I was went to high school with. And our daughter and her both died in a sanitarium in Norwich, Connecticut, tuberculosis sanitarium. And I got married again to this woman, to this lady, yes, who later became the mother of my children. And I moved out of there with her back in Illinois, and became a crazy person in that town. I had a lot of guns, and I used to carry them with me. I still brought those Hoop Gibson or whatever. And I did so many weird things in that town, and I didn't need to be drunk to do them. I can't blame my activities on, well, I was drunk when I did that. No, I wasn't drunk all the time when I did that. And one of the times that I called the FBI because of the communistic activity inside of a saloon, and there was no action going, so I created something. And they had a newspaper in this town called the Labor News. There was no labor printed in it. There was a scandal sheet, and my picture was on the front of the paper. I was back there last year in this town to make some amends, and back there for a convention. And it said on underneath the caption, Harvey W. Andrews, 432 Winona Drive, drunk, calls FBI because of communistic activity inside the saloon. They named it. Underneath my picture, they put my phone number. Nobody ever calls. I always get a kick out of that because my kids were going to school. My oldest daughter was going to school then. She'd come home and she'd say to me, Dad, you're not really a drunk and a jailbird, are you? And that makes a hole inside of your stomach you got to fill up. You don't know how much it takes to fill that up. And I didn't know that I was. No one knows that what they are until it's too late. You've already become it. Halfway down the track, someone tries to stop you from doing something, and but you don't seem to understand. I'm different. I won't do that. And we always wind up doing it. But I got out of that town because everybody knew me in that town. Everybody knew me in that town. The sheriff knew me. The chief of police knew me. All the deputies knew me, you know. I had a car in that town. I was working part-time, and I worked full-time. Got one time of work day, 2 years straight. You know, only got drunk on Fridays. And I thought, Jesus, I've really got it. I'm really going to make it. And party come along and down. I had a car that 1937 Lincoln Zephyr with a V12 engine in it. You know, painted robin's egg blue. I look like a plow coming down the street. It was really weird. Anyway, I got out of that town, come out to California, the land of fruit and nuts, join the ladder. And I wasn't out here a few days, and I found out what the Azusa Jail looked like, and Temple City Jail, and Lincoln Heights, that's the old Lincoln. They don't have that anymore, I hear. It's an old men's home now or something. They use it for warehousing. But I was so afraid, so many times, so afraid. You know, I get a kick out of the one time when I became a melter in the steel foundry. And I became the only melter in the steel foundry. And that's hell, you know, to have an practicing alcoholic given that much power. And I melt steel, electro-melt furnace. And I got mad at everybody in the plant there one night, and I shut it off and went home. That's the first time that company sent me to a psychiatrist, you know. He had just graduated or something, but he was still on the Freudian theory, and the first thing he opened up with is, were you abused by your mother? And I said, did you abuse yours? You know? He didn't like my attitude, you know? And I didn't like his, anyway. But I had a hell of a time in that area of recognizing me. I didn't want to be the person that I was, and yet I didn't know any other way to change. And I don't think I got here a minute too soon or a minute too late. I got here just the right time. I was supposed to be in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, so I could learn about me, you know. And today I'm married to a lovely lady who's a 10-year black belt Al-Anon. And my sponsor loves her. He really does. And the reason that I have the sponsors I have now, that I'm one of the few people that have been around a few years in sober and Alcoholics Anonymous, who has been a manic, depressive, schizophrenic most of his life, who tried to commit suicide after 10 years of sobriety. And I would not take a pill or drink on that, or trying to die that way, or shoot myself, you know. Or drink, but if I drank, I'd lose my length of sobriety in case I changed my mind. But I became a leaper, and you know, that's one who crawls on top of the parapet wall in the downtown Los Angeles and threatens to jump into the parking lot, you know. Sober, you know. Crazy, but sober. I said my sponsor loves my wife because my wife's the psychiatric nurse. You know, she can always tell me when I go crazy. She can't help me, but she can tell me when I go crazy. You know, but I was sitting on top of that parapet wall, and I tried to go over frontwards. I really wanted to go. And I said, well, I don't want to watch myself go. I'll try it backwards. So I turn around, and I'm leaning over there, really trying to tip over there. I get a good balance. I lean where nothing happened. I must have been up there 10 minutes. And what happened later when I thought about it, no cars came into the parking lot. No car. If a car would have pulled in and parked, some old lady from Pasadena would get out of her car and looked up and said, I think he's going to jump. I'd have said, watch me, because I wouldn't be here. All I needed was an audience. All I needed was an audience to say, don't do that. And off I fell off of that wall, and that was about the third time I tried to commit suicide, and before I tried it drunk a couple times. But I went to the guy who was my sponsor today. He was a lovely person, and the true reason he became my sponsor, because I'm sober longer than he is, but he claims 2 years for being a Lutheran. But I went to his house, and he said, what happened? And I told him what happened, and he said, Harvey, you're doing it wrong. I said, what do you mean? He said, do not stand on the parapet wall contemplating jumping off into the parking lot. When you do it again, like tomorrow, get in the middle of the roof and run. You drive over the parapet wall. You're going to have to get out there. You're going to, no, this isn't it either, you know. And I just had a hell of a time with that. I haven't tried to commit suicide since. One time down in Venice, and I moved to Venice, and one time I was down there, I had, because I have another thing wrong with me also that I gained a lot of control over. It's called agoraphobia, and that's the fear of the fear. I was afraid to go out of the house. I was afraid to go out of town. I was afraid to do some damage and didn't know that there was fear, you know. But I was down in Venice, and I called him on the phone and told him that I was dying one more time, and the beach was on fire. And he said, well, how have you been listening to me before? Are you ambulatory? I said, of course I am. He came down, and we walked down the street. I lived on Rose Avenue then, next to Venice. And we walked down the street, and he said, you see, Harvey, the beach is not on fire. The hotels are not on fire. Everything's fine. And we got right around the corner, and Pacific Ocean Park was burning to the ground. And we stayed up all night and watched that. That's the night when he said, you know, Harvey, people can't wait till I die so they can come and pee on my grave. And I said, I wouldn't do that to you. I'm your friend. I wouldn't do that to you. And he thanked me. He said, geez, I'm so glad, Harvey. I said, besides, I told myself I'd never stand in line again. But, I'm going to finish off with that. Because I'm supposed to get off of here at 10 o'clock? Okay. I'll finish off with talking about the steps and get back to them, because over the years, I thought I wanted to be somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time. And I ran for every office there is to run in AA. I've had every office in general service except delegate. I've had every job to have an institutional work. I'm one of the authors of any group of the institutions. I've had every job there is to have an essential office except executive secretary. I've had every damn job there is to have in AA. And I was around here 10 years before I found out the highest you can get in AA is sober. You can't get any higher than that. So if there's any Little Caesars around here who want to grow and be great, I'll talk to you right after the meeting. But the steps I want to talk about is two steps that nobody particularly wants to do, because it's the fear of letting someone else find out that you're the same. That's what it's all about, really. Because we're all the same. I know that everybody in this room is the same. You know, nobody's different here. You're all alike. You're all cut from the same cloth. The reason I know that, because over the years, I've been a recipient of over 500 inventories from people 17 years of age to 87. And no inventory. The only difference in an inventory is the quantity. So, well, according to how long you've been doing it, you know. But the quality is there, really. So if you would, because, you know, when you get your list and you're writing your inventory, your sex list is nothing, really, when you get down to it. That's the last thing you write about anyway. That's a page and a half of that. And everyone keeps that a secret, you know, what happened in their lifetime. But if you haven't written your inventory yet, if you can think of the dirtiest, nastiest, the rottenest, filthiest thing you've ever done in your lifetime, okay, you think of yours, and I'll think of mine. If you knew, only one. That was Millie, no, it wasn't. Just think of one. Now, whatever you're thinking, I don't care what it has to do with, what it has to do with sex, the Ten Commandments, the seven deadly sins of man, I've already done it. I don't care what it is. For one thing, I've never had an abortion. I thought about it. But I never had an abortion. So if you think of yours and I'll think of mine, supposing you're telling me this great secret, you're never going to tell another living soul. Okay? And I'm sharing with you. And after you tell it to me, I'm not afraid of you. I can't fear you in any way. Am I jealous of you? I don't think so. Am I envious of you? I don't think so. So I don't have any of those. The only thing that's left is the thing that you people taught me here. You know, you people taught me the word. People taught me how to do it, and that's to love you. To love you regardless of where you're at. To love you regardless of what you've done. To never confront another human being because of their past. It's just where you have to make a bond between one another. It's where you find out the Father's really walking alongside of you. Yeah. You stick around long enough in this program, you find out you learn to love your God, whether you have one now or not. And you learn to love His Son. You'll also learn to love all of His sons. Buddha was His son. Yeah. Muhammad was His son. You're His son. All of us are. We're all God's kids. And when we find out about that and we join together, and we join in love, and we join in fellowship, you know, it's a hell of a world out there. It's a beautiful world out there. I've been retired now a year and a half, and I never thought I'd live this long, you know. And I play a lot of golf, and I enjoy life, and I go to my Father with my thoughts, and I go to Him in prayer every morning, and I go to Him in prayer every night, thanking that God of mine for this day, and thanking Him for changing this nut up here to a person who can be stabilized, and I can be a stable person in my family. And I married a woman who has 8 children, and I have 3. I guess it's 11 kids between us, and one of our boys is here tonight. And we have 11 grandchildren. And I tell you, in about 20 more days, you'll see a great change happen in me. My eyes will sink into my head. My cheeks will curl up, and my teeth will be gone. And my little hands will be all crinkled up. I'm going to become a great grandfather. Gee. I told her, how dare you do this to me? Well, it's a beautiful life. God is a life. Come on, join us, you know. But it's a life that you have to give up something, and what you give up is you give up your pride. Yeah, and what you get from giving up your pride, you earn love. They've snatched your integrity away from you out there a long time ago, and you get that back. And you get the love of one another in the room. And you can go unashamedly and cry in front of another human being, which I could never do before. I love you all, and I don't need your permission to love you. Thank you.